everything. What made people want to go on going on, holding on by the skin of their teeth, was not optimism, but hope. Dogged, inextinguishable hope. I say to people that I'm not an optimist, because that, in a sense, is something that depends on feelings more than the actual reality. We feel optimistic, or we feel pessimistic. Now, hope is different in that it is based not on the ephemerality of feelings, but on the firm ground of conviction. I believe with a steadfast faith that there can never be a situation that is utterly, totally hopeless. Hope is deeper and very, very close to unshakable. It's in the pit of your tummy. It's not in your head. It's all here.
He pointed to his abdomen.
Despair can come from deep grief, but it can also be a defense against the risks of bitter disappointment and shattering heartbreak. Resignation and cynicism are easier, more self-soothing postures that do not require the raw vulnerability and tragic risk of hope. To choose hope is to step firmly forward into the howling wind, bearing one's chest to the elements, knowing that in time, the storm will pass.
As the Archbishop was explaining, hope is the antidote to despair. Yet hope requires faith, even if that faith is in nothing more than human nature or the very persistence of life to find a way. Hope is also nurtured by relationship, by community, whether that community is a literal one or one fashioned from the long memory of human striving, whose membership includes Gandhi, King, Mandela, and countless others. Despair turns us inward. Hope sends us into the arms of others. And then the Archbishop turned to me and made it so personal and yet so universal.
In many ways, it's the same kind of thing as love. Why did you propose to Rachel? What made you think it was going to last? You know, you didn't have evidence. A lot of people were as madly in love as you were with her early on. And a few years later, they divorced. But you knew in the depth of your being, this is she for me. As she also said, this is he for me. And, well, you turned out to be right.
Loneliness. No need for introduction.
Throughout society today, people feel great loneliness.
We began our discussion after tea. We were talking about loneliness and alienation and some troubling recent statistics. A study by sociologist Lynn Smith Levin had found that the number of close friends people report having has reduced from 3 to 2. While we might have hundreds of Facebook friends, our true close friends are decreasing. Perhaps most concerning of all, 1 in 10 people said they had no close friendships at all.
Actually, in America and in India also, people in the big cities are very busy, and although they may see each other's faces, or even know each other for several years, they have practically no human connection. So, when something happens, people feel lonely because they have no one they can turn to for help or support.
Having grown up in Manhattan, surrounded by 7 million New Yorkers, I knew exactly what the Dalai Lama was saying. As a boy, I never really met the people who lived on our apartment floor. I would occasionally hear their doors close with an empty metallic clang and locks turn behind them. If we did see them while waiting for the elevator, few words were spoken and eyes were averted. I was always bewildered by this willful avoidance and finally concluded that it must have been a defense against the crush of so many people crowded together.
In rural areas, farmers have had a stronger sense of community. So when someone or some family is facing a problem, you have the feeling that you can ask your neighbors for help. Even in big cities with millions of people, we still have the responsibility for each other, whether we know each other or not.
I thought of the locked doors on our apartment building floor. How could we have responsibility for people we did not even know? Those closed doors and the unseen people behind them were like a constant reminder that we were not connected. Now, as the Dalai Lama was speaking, I wondered if the averted eyes of my childhood, waiting for the elevator or in the subway, were perhaps the shame of being physically close and emotionally distant.
We are same human beings. No need for introduction. Same human face. When we see one another, we immediately know this is a human brother or sister. Whether you know them or not, you can smile and say hello.
I thought of the times that I had smiled and spoken with warmth to the person waiting for an elevator or standing in a subway. Yes, sometimes my bid for human connection was met with confusion, since it was not the social expectation. But most often there was a relieved smile, as if we had broken a trance and were once again acknowledging our human bond.
Our whole society has a materialistic culture. In the materialistic way of life, there is no concept of friendship, no concept of love, just work 24 hours a day like a machine. So, in modern society, we eventually also become part of that large moving machine.
The Dalai Lama was naming a deep pain in the chest of modern life, but one that was so common we had forgotten that it was not normal. I thought of what the Archbishop had said of Ubuntu, how we are who we are through one another, how our humanity is bound up in one another. The Dalai Lama had explained that in Buddhism, there is the recognition of our interdependence on every level, socially, personally, subatomically. The Dalai Lama had often emphasized that we are born and die totally dependent on others, and that the independence that we think we experience in between is a myth.
If we stress secondary level of differences, my nation, my religion, my color, then we notice the differences. Like this moment now in Africa, there is too much emphasis on this nation or that nation. They should think that we are the same Africans. Furthermore, we are same human beings. Same with religion. Shiite and Sunni, or Christian and Muslim. We are same human beings. These differences between religions are personal matters. When we relate to others from the place of compassion, it goes to the first level, the human level, not the secondary level of difference. Then you can even have compassion for your enemy. So, we all have the same potential for affection. And now, scientists are discovering that our basic human nature is compassionate. The problem is that children go to schools where they are not taught to nurture these deeper human values, so their basic human potential becomes dormant.
Perhaps our synagogues, our temples, and our churches are not as welcoming as they should be. I really think we do need for these fellowships to do a great deal more to have those who are lonely come and share. Not in an aggressive way, or in order, as it were, to increase their records or their ranks, but really just keenly interested in one person who comes and gets what they did not have before, warmth and fellowship. There are programs that set out to break down that loneliness.
We often are alone without feeling lonely, and feel lonely when we are not alone, as when we are in a crowd of strangers or at a party of people we do not know. Clearly, the psychological experience of loneliness is quite different from the physical experience of being alone. We can feel joy when we are alone, but not when we are lonely. After our tea break, the dialogue returned to this topic. Your Holiness, we finished our last session talking about loneliness, and I wanted to come back to the subject for one more question. Monks spend a lot of time alone, so what is the difference between being alone and being lonely? The Dalai Lama turned to the Archbishop to see if he wanted to answer.
No, I've not been a monk, man. You start.
Monks separate themselves from the material world, not just physically, but mentally. According to his religion, Christian monks are always thinking they're in the light of God, dedicated to serving God. We cannot touch God directly, so the only way is serving God's children, humanity. So, we are never really lonely. Much depends on your attitude. If you are filled with negative judgment and anger, then you will feel separate from other people. You will feel lonely. But if you have an open heart and are filled with trust and friendship, even if you are physically alone, even living a hermit's life, you will never feel lonely.
It is ironic, isn't it, I offered, remembering Lama Tenzin, who told us while we bought donuts on our way to Dharamsala that he had a desire to live in a cave for the traditional length of over 3 years. You can spend 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days in a cave and not be lonely, but you can be lonely in the middle of a crowd.
That's right. There are at least 7 billion people, and the number of sentient beings is limitless. If you are always thinking about the 7 billion human beings, you will never experience loneliness. The only thing that will bring happiness is affection and warm-heartedness. This really brings inner strength and self-confidence, reduces fear, develops trust, and trust brings friendship. We are social animals, and cooperation is necessary for our survival, but cooperation is entirely based on trust. When there is trust, people are brought together. Whole nations are brought together. When you have a more compassionate mind and cultivate warm-heartedness, the whole atmosphere around you becomes more positive and friendlier. You see friends everywhere. If you feel fear and distrust, then other people will distance themselves. They will also feel cautious, suspicious, and distrust. Then comes the feeling of loneliness. When someone is warm-hearted, they are always completely relaxed. If you live with fear and consider yourself as something special, then automatically, emotionally, you are distanced from others. You then create the basis for feelings of alienation from others and loneliness. So, I never consider, even when giving a talk to a large crowd, that I am something special. I am His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I always emphasize that when I meet people, we are all the same human beings. 1,000 people, same human being. 10,000 or 100,000, same human being. Mentally, emotionally, and physically. Then, you see, no barrier. Then my mind remains completely calm and relaxed. If too much emphasis on myself, and I start to think I am something special, then more anxiety, more nervousness. The paradox is that although the drive behind excessive self-focus is to seek greater happiness for yourself, it ends up doing exactly the opposite. When you focus too much on yourself, you become disconnected and alienated from others. In the end, you also become alienated from yourself. Since the need for connection with others is such a fundamental part of who we are as human beings. This excessive self-focus is also bad for your health. Too much fear and distrust, too much focus on yourself, leads to stress and high blood pressure. Many years ago, I was at a gathering of medical scientists and researchers at Columbia University in New York. One of the medical scientists said in his presentation that those people who disproportionately use the first-person pronouns, I, me, and mine, have a significantly greater risk of having a heart attack. He didn't explain why, but I felt this must be true. This is a deep insight. With too much self-focus, your vision becomes narrow. And with this, even a small problem appears out of proportion and unbearable. Also, fear, and distrust come from too much focus on yourself. This will cause you to always remain separate from your human brothers and sisters. This brings loneliness and difficulty communicating with other people. After all, you are part of the community, so you have to deal with them. Your interests and your future depend on other people. If you isolate yourself from them, how can you be a happy person? You just have more worry and more stress. Sometimes I say that too much self-centeredness closes our inner door, and it becomes hard to communicate with other people. When we are concerned with the well-being of other human beings, that inner door opens, and we are able to communicate very easily with other people.
The Dalai Lama was saying that when one is thinking about others with kindness and compassion, one is never lonely. Open-heartedness, warm-heartedness, is the antidote to loneliness. It has often amazed me that one day I can walk down the street feeling judgmental and critical of others, and I will feel separate and lonely. And the next day, I can walk down the same street with more open-hearted acceptance and compassion, and suddenly, everyone seems warm and friendly. It is almost as if my inner state of mind and heart changes the physical and social world around me completely. The focus on the importance of warm-heartedness echoes the research of social psychologists Chen Bozong and Shira Gabriel, who have found that when people are feeling lonely or socially rejected, they literally seek warmth, like sipping hot soup. What the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were saying is that we can generate that warmth simply by opening our hearts and turning our attention and our concern to other people. Archbishop, did you want to add anything? I know you haven't been a monastic, but you do spend a lot of time in prayer and meditation on your own.
Certainly, in our sort of prayer, it is never the alone speaking to the alone. Our concept of God is of a God who is one, but who is a fellowship, a community, the Trinity. And we are made in the image of this God. When you become a Christian, you are incorporated into a fellowship. So even when you go into retreat, you are not alone.
It's similar to what the Dalai Lama is saying, I said. If you connect, even if that fellowship is 7 billion people, then you don't feel lonely.
Yes, yes, it is something of an oxymoron to be lonely. But I can very well understand when you feel alienated, when you are not on the same wavelength, as it were. And one wants to enter into that sense of being in solidarity. I don't think we help people by making them feel guilty. We want to try to be as welcoming as we possibly can and say that the experience they have is something that many other people also have. Feeling lonely is not something that we do deliberately. I don't think you set out to say, I want to feel lonely. It's just there. It happens, and for very many reasons. You want to make the person feel really, as they are, special, and accepted as they are, and help to open them. I can very well understand the incredible anguish and pain that someone must feel who is cooped up in a room because they are scared of going out and being rejected. And you just hope and pray that they will find a fellowship of people who will embrace and welcome them. It's wonderful to see people who were closed down open up like a beautiful flower in the warmth and acceptance of those around them.
What I had learned from our dialogue was that we did not have to wait for others to open their hearts to us. By opening our hearts to them, we could feel connected to them, whether on a mountaintop or in the middle of Manhattan. Envy. That guy goes past yet again in his Mercedes-Benz.
It is not that you wake up in the morning and say, now I'm going to be envious. It just rises spontaneously. I mean, you get up and you're trying to be a good person, and that guy goes past yet again for the third time this week in his Mercedes-Benz or some other very nice car. You have been trying not to feel jealous each time he passes with his car. But this feeling just comes up.
Comparison is indeed human, even beyond human. It is natural throughout the animal world. As the Dalai Lama would point out, even dogs that are eating together peacefully can suddenly start comparing the size of their portion to another's, and a fight can break out with barking and the gnashing of teeth. But it is for humans that envy can become a source of great dissatisfaction. There is a Tibetan Buddhist teaching that says what causes suffering in life is a general pattern of how we relate to others. Envy toward the above, competitiveness toward the equal, and contempt toward the lower. Fairness seems to be hardwired into our genes, and so we are very uncomfortable with inequality of any sort. Primatologist Franz De Waal has a video of an experiment with capuchin monkeys, our distant relatives, who are often used in psychological tests as proxies for humans. In the video, which has gone wildly viral, one of the small-headed, long-limbed gray monkeys gives the experimenter a rock and then receives a cucumber slice as payment. The monkey is quite happy to do this over and over until he sees his neighbor perform the same rock-giving task, but receive a grape. In the world of capuchin monkeys, a grape is a better, sweeter food than a cucumber. Perhaps for humans, too. After the first monkey sees his neighbor getting a grape, he performs the rock-giving task yet again, although even more eagerly this time, his head now perking up in expectation at his grape reward. However, as required in this experiment of social comparisons, the experimenter gives the first monkey another cucumber instead of a grape. The capuchin looks at the cucumber in his hand, pulling his head back in seeming disbelief, and then throws the cucumber back at the experimenter. In uncontrollable rage, the monkey grabs the bars of the cage and shakes them. This video became popular during the time of the Wall Street protests in the United States because it so succinctly and poignantly revealed how our fundamental instincts for fairness work and why inequality is stressful and damaging to a society. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama spoke frequently through the week of dialogues about the need to address inequality on the societal level. Yet however much we address these large global imbalances, as the Archbishop has pointed out, there will always be people who have more than we do, or who are more successful, or who are more talented, or smarter, or better looking. Usually we don't actually compare ourselves to the hedge fund billionaire, or to the genius scientist, or to the supermodel. We tend to compare ourselves to those who are in our social circle. As the old saying goes, if you want to be poor, find some rich friends. If you want to be rich, find some poor friends. Keeping up with the Joneses happens within a peer group. Jinpa told me that in the 1990s, the United States gave green cards to about 1,000 Tibetans in India as part of a special program for refugees. When these Tibetans started sending dollars back to their families, their neighbors started to get jealous because suddenly these families had more disposable income and could renovate their homes or buy their children motorbikes. It's not that those families who had no one in the States had become poorer. It's that their neighbors with family in the States had suddenly become richer. According to the happiness research, upward comparisons are particularly corrosive to our well-being. Envy doesn't leave room for joy. The Tibetan word for envy is trakdok, which means heavy or constricted shoulders. And indeed, the feeling of envy leaves one with a pinched feeling of discontent and resentment, tinged with guilt. Buddhism sees envy as so corrosive that it compares it to a venomous snake that poisons us. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, one of the Ten Commandments forbids coveting thy neighbor's house. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama were in disagreement about how to respond to envy, with the Archbishop coming down on the side of acceptance and self-forgiveness.
I mean, you don't really have a great deal of control over it. I think far too frequently we are too hard on ourselves. We forget that many of these things affect all of us universally. I would hope that we could help people dissipate the guilt that they also tend to have, because almost everybody, when they are feeling envious, also has guilt attached to it. I would say The thing that we want to be saying to God's children out there is, for goodness sake, there are things about us that we do not control.
The Archbishop then went on to offer a powerful remedy for envy, gratitude.
I think that one of the best ways you can begin to counter it is that old one of counting your blessings. That might sound very old, grandfatherly style, but yes, it does help. You know, you might not have as big a house as that person, but you know what? You're not living in a shack. So being thankful for the things that you do in fact have can help.
And then he offered another remedy, motivation.
Certainly with envy, it can also be a spur, you know. It can help you say, I haven't got a car or a house like that guy, so why don't I aim to work and try and get something like that?
As the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama had said, these external goals will not bring us true joy or lasting happiness, but motivation to improve our situation is certainly better than envy of someone else's. And then the Archbishop offered his final and most effective remedy, reframing.
The very best is being able to ask yourself, why do I want to have a house that has 7 rooms when there are only 2 or 3 of us? Why do I want to have it? And you can turn it on its head and look at how we are in such a mess with climate change because of our galloping consumption, which for the environment has been nothing less than disastrous. So you buy the small electric car instead, and you say, no, I don't need or want that big luxury car. So instead of it being your enemy, now it's your ally.
Jinpa translated what the Archbishop had said for the Dalai Lama.
That's exactly what I said.
Fortunately, you do not understand Tibetan.
The Dalai Lama shot back with a quick smile, and then I saw him do what each of them did throughout the dialogues when they would come to a point of disagreement, reaffirm the relationship and compliment the other. It made me think of relationship scientists John Gottman and Julie Schwartz Gottman's observation that in successful conflict, there is a softened startup, or a delicate entry into the area of disagreement.
So, I think, from my viewpoint, my spiritual brother's explanation is wonderful, wonderful. You see, at the very moment that envy or jealousy develops, you no longer can maintain your peace of mind. So jealousy actually destroys your peace of mind. Then that jealousy can become corrosive to the relationship. Even with your good friend, if you develop some sort of jealousy, it will be very harmful to your friendship. Even with husband and wife, if some kind of jealousy develops, it will be very harmful to the marriage. We can see it even with dogs that are eating in a happy atmosphere peacefully. But if one becomes jealous of what another has, conflict. Fighting. It is important to cultivate any emotion that brings joyfulness and peace of mind. Any sort of emotion that disturbs this happiness and peace of mind, we must learn to avoid right from the beginning. I think it is a mistake just to consider all of these negative emotions, like anger or jealousy, as normal parts of our mind, something we cannot do much about. Too many negative emotions destroy our own peace of mind, our health, and create trouble in our family, with our friends, and in our community. Often envy comes because we are too focused on material possessions and not on our true inner values. When we focus on experience or knowledge, there is much less envy. But most important is to develop a sense of concern for others' well-being. If you have genuine kindness or compassion, then when someone gets something or has more success, you are able to rejoice in their good fortune. For a person who is committed to compassion practice and a genuine sense of concern for others' well-being, then you will rejoice in others' good fortune because you will be happy that what that person aspires for is being obtained.
The Dalai Lama was describing the Buddhist concept of mudita, which is often translated as sympathetic joy, and described as the antidote to envy. Mudita is so important in Buddhism that it is considered one of the four immeasurables, qualities we can cultivate infinitely. The other three are loving-kindness, compassion, and equanimity. Jibba had explained how mudita works. If someone has something that we want, say, a bigger house, we can consciously take joy in their good fortune by telling ourselves, good for him. Just like me, he too wants to be happy. He too wants to be successful. He too wants to support his family. May he be happy. I congratulate him and want him to have more success. Mudita recognizes that life is not a zero-sum game, that there is not just one slice of cake in which someone else is taking more means we get less. Mudita sees joy as limitless. As mentioned earlier, mudita is also the opposite feeling to Schadenfreude, the German word for the feeling of satisfaction or pleasure in hearing of others' misfortune. Schadenfreude sees us in a constant struggle of one against all others. And if someone else succeeds or accomplishes something, then we are somehow diminished, less successful, less acceptable, less lovable. Schadenfreude is a natural outgrowth of envy. Mudita is a natural outgrowth of compassion. Mudita is based on the recognition of our interdependence, or our Ubuntu. The Archbishop explains that in African villages, one would ask in greeting, "How are we?" This understanding sees that someone else's achievements or happiness is in a very real way our own. The Archbishop frequently marvels at the extraordinary beauty and talent that we humans have. "Look how beautiful you all are," he will say to a gathered crowd. Unfortunately, however, most of us want to cut others down to our self-perceived size, and we see ourselves as so terribly small and weak. When we remember our interdependence, we discover we are so incredibly large and strong.
There is an old story from the time of the Buddha. One day, a king invited the Buddha and his monks for lunch. On his way to the palace, the Buddha passed by a beggar who was praising the king and smiling as he spoke of the beauty of the palace. After the king's servants served a long meal with many courses to the Buddha and his gathering of monks, the time came for making the dedication. The Buddha chanted a prayer to dedicate the merit or the good karma of the meal. However, instead of dedicating the merit of the host, the king who made the generous offering of the meal to the Buddha and his assembly, which was the custom, the Buddha chose the beggar standing outside. Shocked, one of his senior monks asked the Buddha why he chose the beggar for his dedication prayer. The Buddha replied that the king was filled with pride in showing off his kingdom, while the beggar, who had nothing, was able to rejoice in the king's good fortune. For this reason, the beggar had created more merit than the king. Even today in Thailand, they maintain this tradition of dedicating the merit of the offering of a meal. During my visit to Thailand in the early 1970s, I had the honor to participate in one such lunch, where one of the senior monks said prayers and offered the dedication. So rejoicing in others' good fortune really brings a lot of positive benefits.
How, I asked the Dalai Lama, do people cultivate mudita?
Firstly, we should recognize our shared humanity. These are our human brothers and sisters, who have the same right and the same desire to have a happy life. This is not a spiritual thing. It is simply common sense. We are part of the same society. We are part of the same humanity. When humanity is happy, we will be happy. When humanity is peaceful, our own lives are peaceful. Just like if your family is happy, you are better off. If we have a strong sense of I and they, it is hard to practice mudita. We must develop the sense of we. Once you're able to develop that sense of common humanity and the oneness of humanity, then, naturally, you will want all others to be free from suffering and enjoy happiness. The desire for happiness is a natural instinct shared by everyone. It is simply a sense of concern, once again, for others' well-being.
Obviously, envy is not a virtue. Yet I would hope we would not make someone feel guilty, at least initially, about something that springs up spontaneously. You can't do very much about that feeling, but you can counter it.
Like physical illness, preventive measures are the best way. Yes, if some disease has already developed, then there's no other choice but to take medicine. So, similarly, once a person develops a strong negative emotion, like anger or jealousy, it is very difficult to counter it at that moment. So the best thing is to cultivate your mind through practice so that you can learn to prevent it from arising in the first place. For example, the major source of anger is frustration and dissatisfaction. At the moment when an emotion like anger is full-blown, even if we try to use our experience and our knowledge to reduce it, we will find it is very difficult to stop. At that point, it is like a flood. During a monsoon season, it is too late to stop the flooding. We need to start early in the spring and investigate what is causing the flooding and try to build flood walls to prevent disaster. Similarly, for our mental health also, the earlier we start practicing preventive measures, the easier and more effective they are. When we are already sick, it is hard to remember our doctor's advice. I think no doctor would say, if you have more anger, you will be healthier. Does your doctor say that?
No.
Doctors always advise us to relax. Relax means calm mind. Not too much agitation, which will destroy your relaxation. Also, too much attachment will destroy your peace of mind. You can have a nice house with a nice bedroom and a nice bath and play relaxing music. But if you are full of anger, full of jealousy, full of attachment, you will never be able to relax. In contrast, you may be sitting on a rock with nothing. But if your mind is completely peaceful, then you can be relaxed.
Jinpa told me that there is a memorable verse in a well-known Tibetan text by the first Panchen Lama. This is a beautiful prayer that Jinpa uses to cultivate mudita. As for suffering, I do not wish even the slightest. As for happiness, I am never satisfied. In this, there is no difference between others and me. Bless me, so I may take joy in others' happiness. Suffering and adversity. Passing through difficulties.
There is a Tibetan saying that adversities can turn into good opportunities. Even a tragic situation can become an opportunity. There's another Tibetan saying that it is actually the painful experiences that shine the light on the nature of happiness. They do this by bringing joyful experiences into sharp relief. You can see this in an entire generation that has experienced great difficulties, like you, Archbishop. When you got your freedom, you really felt joyous. Now, the new generation, who are born after, they don't know the true joy of freedom and complain more.
I remembered seeing the lines of people who had waited for hours and hours to vote in the first democratic election in South Africa in 1994. The lines snaked on for miles. I remember wondering at the time, as U.S. voter turnout was hovering under 40%, how long that sense of joy and appreciation for the right to vote would last, and whether there was any way to revive it in America, among those who have never been denied the right to vote.
I think in Europe, too, the older generation really went through great hardships. They were hardened and strengthened by those painful experiences. So, this shows that the Tibetan saying is really true. The suffering is what makes you appreciate the joy.
As the Dalai Lama was speaking, I could not help thinking of how we try so hard, with our natural parental instinct, to save our children from pain and suffering. But when we do, we rob them of their ability to grow and learn from adversity. I recalled psychologist and Auschwitz survivor Edith Eva Eger saying that the spoiled, pampered children were the first to die at Auschwitz. They kept waiting for others to come save them, and when no one came, they gave up. They had not learned how to save themselves.
Many people think of suffering as a problem. Actually, it is an opportunity destiny has given to you. In spite of difficulties and suffering, you can remain firm and maintain your composure.
I understood what the Dalai Lama was saying, but how do we actually embrace our suffering and see it as an opportunity while we are in the middle of it? Certainly, this was easier said than done. Jinpa had mentioned that in the Tibetan spiritual teaching known as the 7-point mind training, 3 categories of people are identified as being special objects of focus because these are the most challenging: your family members, your teachers, and your enemies. 3 objects, 3 poisons, and 3 roots of virtue, Jinpa explained the meaning of this cryptic and intriguing phrase. Often it is our day-to-day interaction with these 3 objects that give rise to the 3 poisons of attachment, anger, and delusion, which are at the heart of so much suffering. Through spiritual training, we have the opportunity to transform our engagement with our family, teachers, and adversaries into the development of the 3 roots of virtue: non-attachment, compassion, and wisdom.
Many Tibetans spent years in Chinese gulags, work camps where they were tortured and forced to do hard labor. This, some of them told me, was a good time to test the real person and their inner strength. Some lost hope. Some kept going. Education had very little to do with who survived. In the end, it was their inner spirit or warm-heartedness that made the real difference.
I'd expected the Dalai Lama to say that it was their fierce resolve and determination that had made the difference. It was fascinating to hear that it was what he called inner spirit or warm-heartedness that had allowed some to endure the hardships of the gulags. The Archbishop now responded to the Dalai Lama with a question, echoing the one I had asked at the beginning of our discussion. We had been clear from the beginning that this book was to be about joy in the face of life's inevitable suffering and not some abstract or aspirational theory of joy. We wanted listeners to know how to maintain joy at the most trying moments of our life, not just when all was, to quote the Archbishop, hunky-doriness.
He is asking, how do we help people who really want to be joyful, who really want to see the world become a better place? They look at the world, and they see the horrendous problems there are, and they face quite extraordinary adversity in their own lives. Why are you joyful, even when you see these problems and have faced such challenges? There are very, very many people in the world who do want to be good, who want to be joyful, who want to be like you. I mean, how do they get to have this calm in the midst of it all? And yes, I think that you are the most eloquent statement, but they want us now to translate that statement into language that they can understand. This is what we want to tell them. We say that you will be surprised by the joy the minute you start being too self-regarding. Of course, you have to be somewhat self-regarding, because the Lord that I follow said, taking it from the scripture, love thy neighbor as
you.
Yes, thyself. Love others as you love yourself.
Yes, yes.
You must long for the best for that other, as you would want the best for you.
That's right. They look on you and they see you as a wonderful guru or teacher, and not just a teacher, but an embodiment, and they long to be able to have the same calm and joy, even when they have all of the many, many, many frustrations like you have encountered. This, I think, merits discussion. You see, in reality, Like our physical body, where growth takes time, our mental development also takes time. Minute by minute, day by day, month by month, year by year, decade by decade. Perhaps I will share a story from my own life. When I was 16, I lost my freedom in two senses. The previous Dalai Lama had not taken on political responsibility until he was 18. But in my case, the people asked me to become head of the government early because the situation was very serious, as the Chinese military had already invaded the eastern part of Tibet. When the Chinese authorities reached Lhasa, things became even more delicate, and I lost my freedom in a second way, as they severely restricted my actions. This political responsibility also greatly damaged my studies. As I carried out my Geshe examinations at the major monastic universities around Lhasa in central Tibet, the Tibetan soldiers had to stand guard on the mountainside nearby. Then my final examination was to be in the courtyard of the central temple in Lhasa. There were some worries about the Chinese military, and some Tibetan officials wanted to change the location because they thought it was too dangerous. But I said I did not think it was necessary. But during the debate, I had a lot of anxiety and worry, not just for my safety, but also for that of my people. So then, at age 24, when I escaped to India in March 1959, I lost my own country. In one way, this made me very sad, particularly when I think of the serious questions of whether the Tibetan nation, with its unique cultural heritage, will actually survive or not. The Tibetan civilization has existed for 10,000 years, and in some areas of the Tibetan plateau, human habitation existed for as many as 30,000 years. And today's situation of Tibet is the most serious crisis in the entire history of the nation. During the Cultural Revolution, some Chinese officials made a pledge that within 15 years, the Tibetan language must be eliminated. So they burned books, such as the 300-volume Tibetan Canon of Scriptures, translated from India, as well as several thousand volumes written by Tibetans themselves. I was told that the books would burn for 1 or 2 weeks. Our statues and our monasteries were being destroyed. So it was a very, very serious situation. And when we came to India as refugees in 1959, we were strangers in a new place. As the Tibetan saying goes, the only things that were familiar to us were the sky and the earth. But we received immense help from the Indian government and some international organizations, including some Christian organizations, who rebuilt the Tibetan community so that we could keep our culture, our language, and our knowledge alive. So a lot of difficulties, a lot of problems. But when you carry out the work, and the more difficulties you encounter, then when you see some results, the greater the joy, isn't it?
The Dalai Lama was now turning to the Archbishop for confirmation.
Yes.
You see, if there are no difficulties and you are always relaxed, then you complain more.
The Dalai Lama laughed at the irony that we could experience more joy in the face of great adversity than when life is seemingly easy and uneventful. The Archbishop was laughing too. Joy, it seemed, was a strange alchemy of mind over matter. The path to joy, like with sadness, did not lead away from suffering and adversity, but through it. As the Archbishop had said, nothing beautiful comes without some suffering. Jinpa shared how the Dalai Lama often viewed his exile as an opportunity. His Holiness often says that when you become a refugee, you get closer to life, Jinpa said, speaking no doubt from his own experience as well, because there is no room for pretense. In this way, you get closer to truth. Archbishop, I said, maybe we could turn to you for a moment. The Dalai Lama is saying that you actually feel more joy after you've succeeded in the face of opposition. I stopped as I saw the Archbishop gazing at the Dalai Lama with a sense of amazement.
I'm really actually very humbled listening to His Holiness, because I frequently mention to people the fact of His serenity and His calm and joyfulness. We would probably have said in spite of the adversity, but it seems like He's saying because of the adversity, that this has evolved for Him.
The Archbishop was holding the Dalai Lama's hand, patting and rubbing his palm affectionately.
It just increases my own personal admiration for him. It almost seems perverse, but one wants to say thank goodness that the Chinese invaded Tibet. Yes, because I don't think that we would have had the same contact. We certainly would not have had the same friendship. You probably would not have got a Nobel Peace Prize.
The Dalai Lama was now also laughing as they poked fun at these esteemed prizes, as if to say that we can never know what in the end will come of our suffering and adversity, what is good and what is bad. Certainly, he was not saying that the Peace Prize or their friendship would somehow justify the suffering of millions that the Chinese invasion had caused, but in a bizarre way, perverse, really, as the Archbishop had said, the Dalai Lama would never have become a global spiritual leader without being chased out of his cloistered kingdom. It reminded one of the famous Chinese story about the farmer whose horse runs away. His neighbors are quick to comment on his bad luck. The farmer responds that no one can know what is good and what is bad. When the horse comes back with a wild stallion, the neighbors are quick to comment, this time talking about the farmer's good luck. Again, the farmer replies that no one can know what is good and what is bad. When the farmer's son breaks his leg trying to tame the wild stallion, the neighbors now are certain of the farmer's bad luck. Again, the farmer says that no one knows. When war breaks out, all the able-bodied young men are conscripted into battle except the farmer's son, who was spared because of his broken leg.
But to come to your question, I was thinking, as the Dalai Lama was speaking, about something that was personal, although perhaps you could extrapolate it more generally. I'm thinking of Nelson Mandela. As we said, Nelson Mandela, when he went to prison, was a very angry young man, or youngish man. He was the commander-in-chief of the military wing of the ANC, as we said. He believed firmly that the enemy had to be decimated, and he and his comrades had been found guilty in a travesty of justice. That is the guy who went in, aggressive and angry. He comes onto Robben Island and is mistreated, as most of them were. Today, when people go and they see his cell, there's a bed. They didn't have a bed. They were sleeping on the floor. No mattress, just a thin little thing. These were sophisticated, educated people. What do they do? What are they made to do? They are made to go and dig in a quarry. And they are wearing very inadequate clothing. Nelson Mandela and all of them wore shorts, even in winter. They were made to do almost senseless work, breaking rocks and sewing post office bags. He was a highly qualified lawyer. There he's sitting and sewing.
During a visit to Robben Island with Ahmed Kathrada, one of Mandela's colleagues and fellow prisoners, he showed us in the cafeteria the different rations that were given to the prisoners based on their race, a daily reminder of the obsessive racial fascism that they were fighting. 6 ounces of meat for coloreds, Asiatics, and 5 ounces for Bantus, blacks. 1 ounce of jam or syrup for coloreds, Asiatics, and none for Bantus.
I mean, it must have frustrated him to no end, made him very, very angry. God was good and said, you're going to stay here 27 years. And after those 27 years, he emerges on the other side as someone of immense magnanimity. Because, in an extraordinary way, his suffering helped to grow him. Where they thought it was going to break him, it helped him. It helped him to see the point of view of the other. 27 years later, he comes out, kind, caring, ready to trust his erstwhile enemy.
So how did he do it, I asked. I mean, why do you think he was able to see his suffering as ennobling rather than embittering?
He didn't see it. It happened.
So why did it happen for him? Because for others it is not.
Yes, of course. Some people it would embitter.
The Archbishop had once explained to me that suffering can either embitter us or ennoble us, and that the difference lies in whether we are able to find meaning in our suffering. Without meaning, when suffering seems senseless, we can easily become embittered. But when we can find a shred of meaning, or redemption, in our suffering, it can ennoble us, as it did for Nelson Mandela.
One has learned, in very many instances, that for us to grow in generosity of spirit, we have to undergo, in some way or other, a diminishing, a frustration. You may not always think of it as being so. There are very few lives that just move smoothly from beginning to end. They have to be refined.
What is it that needs to be refined?
Our almost natural response is, when I'm hit, I hit back. When you have been refined, you want to find out what it is that impelled this other one to do what he did. And so you put yourself in the shoes of the other. So it is almost an axiom that generosity of spirit seems to require that one will have had setbacks to remove the dross. Removing the dross and learning, yes, to put yourself in the shoes of the other. And it seems almost without fail that generosity of spirit requires that we will have experienced, if not suffering, then at least frustrations. Things that seem to want to stop us from moving in the particular direction that we have chosen. You don't move easily, straightforwardly like this. There are things that force you off course, and you have to come back. It is probably something like your muscle. I mean, if you want a good muscle tone, you know, you work against it, offering it resistance, and it will grow. If you are limp, it won't grow. You can't expand the volume of a chest just by sitting. You have to walk up mountains. There's a measure of going against, as it were, your nature. Your natural longing is to want to sit still. But if you do that and become a sofa cabbage or a couch potato, it's going to show. So what is true physically is, in a wonderful way, true spiritually as well. Deep down, we grow in kindness when our kindness is tested.
Absolutely, absolutely. This reminds me of my friend who told me about being sent to a Chinese gulag at the time I escaped from Tibet. The night I fled from the palace of Norbulinka, I went to a chapel to pay my respects, knowing that it was likely the last time I would ever see it again. My friend, who was already a senior monk at Namgyal Monastery, was there at the chapel. Lopon La, as he is affectionately known by his fellow monks, did not know it was me, because my visit was top secret, and I could not tell him. Then, as soon as I had left the palace, the Chinese bombardment started. They arrested many people, and about 130 were sent to a very remote area, like during Stalin's rule, when people were sent to Siberia. After 18 years of hard labor, Lopon La was able to come to India, and he told me what had happened during his time in the work camp. They had no shoes, even during the very coldest of days. Sometimes it was so cold that when you spit, it would land as ice. They were always hungry. One day, he was so hungry that he tried to eat the body of one of the other prisoners that had died. But the flesh of the dead person was frozen and too hard to bite. Throughout the whole time, they tortured the prisoners. There is Soviet-style torture, and Japanese-style torture, and Chinese-style torture. And at this camp, they combined them all into an immensely cruel kind of torture. When he left the camp, only 20 people had survived. He told me that during those 18 years, he faced some real dangers. I thought, of course, he was talking about dangers to his life. He told me he was in danger of losing his compassion for his Chinese gods.
I could hear a gasp in the room at this extraordinary statement, that the greatest danger for this man had been the risk of losing his compassion, losing his heart, losing his humanity.
Now he is still alive, age 97, and his mind is still in very good shape, sharp and healthy. So, as you mentioned, his spirituality and his experience reinforced his ability for compassion, his human qualities. There are a number of cases where Tibetans, who spent many years of hard labor in Chinese gulags, told me that it was their best period of spiritual practice, for developing patience and compassion. One of my personal physicians, Dr. Tenzin Chozak, who years later managed to come to India, was quite clever. In the gulag, he was prevented from having the rosary and was forced to read Chairman Mao's red book. So he used the syllables of the words as his rosary and recited Buddhist prayers. But in the eyes of the Chinese guards, he was very seriously studying Mao's book. So, like in Nelson Mandela's case, when you are imprisoned, as you said, it's normal to experience great difficulties. But these experiences can, with the right way of thinking, lead you to have great inner strength. So I think that this is something very useful, particularly when we're passing through difficulties.
I was quite struck by the Dalai Lama's phrase of passing through difficulties. We often feel that suffering will engulf us or that the suffering will never end. But if we can realize that it too will pass, or as the Buddhists say, that it is impermanent, we can survive it more easily and perhaps appreciate what we have to learn from it, finding the meaning in it so that we come out the other side not embittered but ennobled. The depth of our suffering can also result in the height of our joy. Shantideva, the Buddhist monk and scholar, described the virtues of suffering. Because of the shock suffering causes us, our arrogance falls away. Suffering also gives rise to compassion for all others who are suffering, and because of our experience of suffering, we avoid actions that will bring suffering to others. Lopunla and Dr. Chodrak would have known these teachings by Shantideva and may have clung to them during the years of hardship and seemingly endless suffering, making meaning out of what must have at times felt like meaningless agony. The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were emphasizing that some degree of tolerance and acceptance is essential, as is realizing that these sorrows happen to all people, not just to us, and not because we have done anything wrong. The year before our dialogues, my father fell down a flight of stairs and suffered a traumatic brain injury. The doctors explained that with a broken bone, we know exactly how long it will take to heal, but with the brain, we never know how it will heal and if it will heal completely. For more than a month, he was in the intensive care unit and neuro rehab, in varying states of delirium, as we worried whether he would ever return to his former self, to his great mind and heart. I will never forget the first telephone call I received from him from the hospital, since we did not know if he would ever be able to communicate consciously again. When my brother was visiting with my dad, he said, "I'm so sorry you've had this terrible experience." My father replied, "Oh no, not at all. It's all part of my curriculum." Illness and fear of death. I prefer to go to hell. The trip was bookended by funerals. We had to change the flight itinerary to India and back twice because dear friends of Archbishop Tutu had died. Although these were funerals for men who had lived good long lives, it was a fitting reminder of death and of the limited time each of us has. Certainly illness and mortality are two of the great verities and sources of suffering in our lives. "Be careful. Lots of my friends are dying," the Archbishop said when we had just arrived at the airport, wagging a finger at the Dalai Lama. Then he went on to say what a great man Philip Potter, one of the deceased, had been. He was the first black general secretary of the World Council of Churches, he explained. But with the archbishop, sanctity and levity, death and life were close bedfellows, so even as he was honoring his friend, he began to tell a joke.
He was a very formidable man, much taller than you and me. Yesterday I was looking at his coffin. It was a massive thing. Both of us would have gone in there. And I would have gone to heaven, and where would you have gone?
Most probably hell.
The conversation about death and who was going to heaven and hell was one of the jokes that they played with throughout the week, making fun of their traditions and conflicting pieties. I asked them to make the subject of illness and death more personal. How do you think about your own deaths? You're both in your 80s, and it's a reality, or at least a possibility, hopefully far in the future.
Quite polite.
Well, he doesn't mind too much, because for him there's reincarnation.
With reincarnation, I'm not really sure where I will be born. So much uncertainty. But you are quite sure you are going to heaven.
Since the Chinese say they are going to decide where you are reincarnated, you must be nice to them.
The archbishop then looked down as if focusing inwardly on the seriousness of the question, his own mortality.
I should say that for a very long time, the thought of my demise was something that brought a great deal of anxiety. I know I've had a number of near-fatal illnesses. As a child, I had polio, and they say that my father went off to buy the wood for making my coffin, and my mother went off to get herself black clothes because they thought I was at the end. In my teenage years, I developed tuberculosis and went to a TB hospital, where I noticed that almost all of the patients who started to hemorrhage, coughing up blood, ended up being pushed out on a trolley to the mortuary. I must have been about 15 or so when I began coughing up blood, too. I was sitting down with this receptacle in front of me, and each time I coughed, blood just came out that way. I said, "God, if you want, if this is curtains for me, then it's okay." I have to admit that I was surprised at the calm and the peace that came over me. But of course you know that they didn't wheel me out on a trolley to the mortuary. Many years later, I met up with Archbishop Trevor Huddleston, who used to come when I was in hospital and visit me weekly for months on end. So it was many years after, when we were both archbishops, that he said he was told by the doctor, "Your young friend," meaning me, "is not going to make it." Well, I guess I seem to have made it for a bit since then.
I have often thought about the strength that the archbishop gained from facing illness and death so early in life. Illness is one of the most common sources of suffering and adversity that people